Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County, not just wine country, but farm country, and food country in a way that is so fundamental to a good life every single day. Today, I'm very happy to be welcoming back to At the Table a friend of the show, Kim Severson from the New York Times. But Kim, you're from a lot of places, aren't you?
I am, Clark. It's great to be on the show again. And yes, I have. You and I, we've spent time in the Bay Area together during the years I was there, and I was in New York City for many years, and now here I am in Atlanta, Georgia.
You know, for a discussion of restaurant criticism some years ago, Ruth Reichel was on a panel I was doing at NYU, and she said that at that time, if she was still writing about restaurants, she would want to be in Las Vegas, because that was a moment when things were really exploding in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. It seems American cities have their moments. They flare up, and then they settle in, they flare up. Atlanta and the South in general has really been on the food radar of this country for a while, hasn't it?
I think it's true, particularly, you know, Charleston is, I think, in the way that New Orleans was, and I think always will be, really one of the important food cities in the country right now. I think and I've certainly eaten a lot of them, but if you eat in Charleston now, I mean, you can barely go wrong. There's some really great food happening in Charleston. Atlanta's a funny town. You know, Atlanta has always been it's named after the terminus. It's a place where the trains were coming and going, where, you know, when the South was trying to climb out of the terrible period of Jim Crow and enslavement, you know, Atlanta was trying to become the new South, you know, the Reconstructionist South. So there's always been a lot of energy. And in the Deep South, certainly Atlanta is the city a lot of young people aspire to come to and cook in. And now we're having folks who are either tired of cooking in the big cities, they can't afford it, and they've really got that agricultural fever. And really the South is about agriculture. You know, that's really what defines the Southern table. But they're coming down here cooking, and they're finding that there is this this concept of the welcome table, which is a way to sort of this idea that we can solve a lot of our problems if we sit down and eat together. That idea of coming together around the table is really vibrant here in the South.
You know, you brought something up, and I want to kind of take these piece by piece, because you just said so many good things. The agricultural history. I mean, we're in an era where when you describe a restaurant, farm to table is almost like saying and has tables and chairs. Mm-hmm. Right? It's so fundamental, but it really is the history of American of Southern cookery to come right from the farm, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's so many paths we can take that. So, you know, the South is still a very agricultural place, very, very seasonal, in ways that, you know, I should think California was the most seasonal place I'd ever been to, but down here it really is. And, you know, cooking from what you had, making do with what you had, has long been a tradition. Appalachian cooking, and certainly the cooking of people who were enslaved, and also, you know, for all sort of economic levels, you were really trying to cook with what you had down here. The South was cut off from some of the major travel routes in the rest of the country, so people turned to the fields and turned to what they had, and so that's why you have these great agricultural traditions. It's so regional here, Clark. I often tell people that the South is like the Italy of America, because if you took even, say, collard greens or field peas or something that would be a very traditional Southern dish, and you know, you could be in one county in North Carolina and they're cooking those collard greens with red pepper flakes and eating them between two little discs of fried cornbread, and then if you went to deep southern Alabama or Mississippi, they're going to be cooking their collards in a much different way, and they might use a little vinegar. They might use serve them with fish down on the off the Gulf Coast. If you go to Arkansas, you'll see fewer greens and more sort of turnip greens, and the greens that are in Arkansas are served differently. It's amazing, and that can go for all kinds of food. So it is really very interesting. I didn't know that till I lived here, but it's a fascinating agricultural place.
We're lucky to have you there. I do love the idea that we could call it the Italy of America, because we used to joke about, I mean, Italy was a series of city-states, right? And they all have very similar dishes and a similar vernacular, but they mean something profoundly, but not really so much different. And the same thing goes for country stuff. Let's talk about people like Edna Lewis, who wrote about Southern cooking, but she also wrote about country cooking. And those are so connected in the South, but not necessarily when that kind of cooking or that kind of farm-based cooking goes to other regions.
Right, and I think what happened, she was a really detested the phrase soul food, although there's some reclamation going of that phrase.
But yeah.
That idea of Southern and Southern country food and country cooking being reduced to, greasy macaroni and cheese,
yeah.
fried chicken,
yeah.
and barbecue as it got translated through the Great Migration North. So, you know, people were going north to find opportunity. The Jim Crow laws here were terrible. The segregation was still very much in effect, and so people went north to work in factories to maybe live a little bit more integrated life,
yeah.
and took with them this notion of soul food as a way to hold on to their Southern identity. And then, of course, over the years, it gets translated into this kind of urban expression of the country life they left behind. And, you know, I think there's something wonderful about macaroni and cheese and fried chicken, and it still is a staple of food here. But
yeah.
it's really a different thing than, you know, than pulling the fresh greens in the spring and using those, and in the fall taking the muscadine grapes and turning them into jellies and wine, and the very seasonal, you know, perfect country cooking, you know, ham that you eat after, you know, butchering it in the fall. And it's a whole different thing, country cooking, than what people think of South and soul food, and what Paula Deen sort of made a good living exploiting.
Exactly. We're talking to Kim Severson. She is a writer for the New York Times. She's written a number of wonderful books exposing things like how trans fats are not a good idea, and how women in her life could be inspiring in profound ways that can be life-saving, individual mentors. And as a writer, that's so important. When you look at Southern food now, and you're discovering all these things, and you've lived in Alaska, you lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, you've lived in New York City, but now you're in the South and you're visiting these places, how has your vision of the farm and country cooking evolved? And I mean, you know, what are its elements for you there?
Well, I think it's probably the same as it is when I was in California, although in California it was a much different, played out differently. But here, if you really know your grower, it makes a big difference. So, you know, I understand the field, like there's probably 40 or 50 different kind of field peas down here. Now, people will think, what is a field pea?
Yeah, what is exactly a field? What's a field pea?
So a field pea could be lady peas or runner peas or black zipper peas, and they're these very tender little peas that used to be, they call them cow peas, that'd be a cover crop, so they'd fix nitrogen in the soil, and they'd plant them, the cows would eat them for feed, and they weren't sort of considered, they were considered what the farm families would eat to kind of sustain them, but they've become quite a delicacy here, and you see them turned into hummus at places like Miller Union, which is Stephen Satterfield's great Southern restaurant in Atlanta, and
yep.
And just simmer them, and they're just so tender and delicious, and they can be tiny and creamy, they can be large and a little bit more meaty, but fresh field peas, and they go bad really quickly, so you have to get them in the couple, 2-3 weeks that they're in season, but fresh field pea season here is just, it was eye-opening to me, so I'm always like trying to find the field peas, and I want to get them fresh, because they'll turn sour pretty quickly, if you don't cook them right away, and learning to cook them is a real art. You talk to any country cook around here, and they'll all have a different method, but they're on every, out in the country, they have a lot of things called meat and threes, and a lot of the modern chefs are recreating the meat and three concept, which is you'll have three vegetables and then some piece of protein, and that was a standard working person's lunch in the South forever. So field peas are always on the meat and three menus, but they're just delicious, and I had no idea what the field pea was until until I started looking into them. And it's interesting, since we're talking about field peas, Tuskegee University, which is in not too far from Selma, Alabama, and it's where George Washington Carver did all of his work with legumes and peanuts, but he really saw the field pea as something that could lift up folks who were freed slaves and needed to find some way to kind of make farming work on their own. And so he encouraged and taught a lot of folks who were suddenly, you know, without a plantation master to take care of them, how to start to grow food on their own and make some economic inroads. And the field pea was one. Well, everybody knows him for the peanut, but it was really the field pea that he spent a lot of time trying to teach people how to grow.
Kim,
there's
so many veg. Yeah, there's so much vegetable. We think of the South as grits and pork, but in fact, there's a lot of veg going on. When we come back in just a minute, we're going to talk a little bit about Atlanta, the modern restaurant city, and a conversation I had with the new food editor of Atlanta Magazine, who says maybe a magazine doesn't need to have a monthly review to be relevant for food. When we come back with Kim Severson from the New York Times, right here at the table. We're back at the table. I'm here talking to Kim Severson of the New York Times. She is currently living in Atlanta and working throughout the South on other projects as well, but focusing on lots of good things. She's been talking to us about field peas. And for those folks who don't have an example in their kitchen or on their table, I think of Dusky Estes from Zazu here in Sonoma County, and she talked about how she always hated fava beans because she had them a couple of days after they'd been picked and not necessarily shelled properly or cleaned properly, and they were kind of starchy and sour and nasty. And then she grew some out back and took them right off the plant and into a pot of water and then pureed them, and she found herself transcended. She found herself transported to another dimension. So, Kim, when we're transporting ourselves to another dimension through vegetables and an occasional protein in Atlanta, when I first visited Atlanta many years ago in the 80s, I really was struck by the fact that there's a lot of great food in Atlanta, but much of it was in home kitchens, sometimes done by private cooks. I mean, this was a pretty successful community that had a lot of well-traveled residents who went many places and loved lots of great things and sometimes would come back and cook those things or teach their private chef to cook those things. But there weren't really kind of restaurants like crazy. Then the boom, and Atlanta's had lots of good restaurants, lots of very talented chefs come forward. And now we're in a period of time where restaurant criticism is so broad, it's so Yelped, it's so blogged and Instagrammed that your local food editor of the Atlanta Monthly has said that maybe roundups are a good idea, in-depth stories are a good idea, but maybe restaurant reviews in a monthly magazine are less relevant or necessary. Kim, I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position, but what do you think about restaurant reviews in a monthly magazine as opposed to daily, you know, newspapers and blogs and bleeps and puppy dogs' tails?
Well, Clark, I actually, this would not be the first uncomfortable position you've put me in. That's why I love you. You know, I, particularly in a smaller city like Atlanta, where getting really good sound advice on how a new restaurant is a little more challenging than it is in New York, where everything gets breathlessly covered in a minute.
Yep.
Same thing with San Francisco. There really aren't, you know, John Kessler was the last great critic we had here, I think, for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And then Bill Addison was writing food criticism at Atlanta Magazine. Now he's the national food critic for Eater.
Yeah.
And John has headed north to Chicago. So we were sort of left with this void. And I, Corby Kummer, a mutual friend,
yep,
was here writing the restaurant reviews for Atlanta Magazine for a bit. And we really all came to count on that. You know, I travel, I cover the whole country for my job now. And, you know, when I come home, I really wanted to know kind of what was going to be great and what would, you know, where I should eat. And also culturally, I think good critics these days, because as you point out, there's so much yelping, and you probably can figure out, the broad contours of whether a place is good or not from Eater or from Yelp or from those kinds of sites. But somebody who could put a place in cultural context really matters more now than I think it ever has. And that's why I love Pete Wells' reviews so much, not only because I think he's pretty fearless and always interesting to read, but, you know, he's a great writer. But it puts things in some context. And I would love to have a good critic in Atlanta who could say, this restaurant means this to this town now as we're looking at this particular place in time. They sort of put a pin in the map for us. And so without a good critic, you miss that. And we certainly, you know, the local newspaper isn't as strong as it once was in criticism. And Atlanta Magazine, you know, this is certain, I have a real fondness for that and for what they're doing. But I miss that restaurant review. And I think in a town like this, it matters. So, and again, for the larger cultural context, as much as anything. So if I had edited Atlanta Magazine, I wouldn't have made that call, but luckily I do not.
Yes, you've got other fish to fry. Well,
do you read criticism still a lot? And what's happening in San Francisco and the Bay? Like, who are people reading these days?
Well, see, what's interesting is that while there's more diversity, and as Krishnendu Ray from NYU used to say, democratization breeds mediocrity. I never look at Yelp. I mean, I barely check Yelp to see if the address is right.
No.
TripAdvisor is a little bit better. Open Table can be helpful if I'm already serious about a place. I do the triangulation that I've always done, which is I ask 3 to 5 friends whom I trust, and then look a couple of places online, into the local newspaper, the local magazine, and cross-reference. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got a minute, for goodness sakes, and it is my meal. I really want it to be okay. And as you said about Atlanta being a crossroads or a terminus, and folks, we're talking to Kim Severson from the New York Times, who is working from Atlanta, but not only on Atlanta. She covers many things that have to do with food and culture and other activities. Atlanta is a bellwether, in a sense. And I'm guessing that in some cases, some of the more deeply Southern traditions or efforts bubble up and come to Atlanta, express themselves in your big city. I mean, one of the things I like about San Francisco is that a lot of things that happen in farm country that we know about going on at wineries, at small restaurants, they bubble up and suddenly they appear in a restaurant in San Francisco. Ruth Reichel, when she was in LA, used to say, she and I called it white guy cuisine. And we could talk about that for a minute, appropriation. But she'd say a young guy, usually from the Culinary Institute of America, would go into a ghetto and come back with a cuisine. You know, fortunately, we're going into neighborhoods that are not our traditional neighborhoods more, in some cases, anyway. And fortunately, we're celebrating more people who are cooking from different traditions and different backgrounds than we've ever done before. There are even some women themselves successfully cooking in New York City. It's a miracle. But you know, that whole kind of relationship between what's out there and what's being shown seems like Atlanta would be a natural for that kind of thing. And in answer to your question, I read P. Wells no matter where I am or what I'm doing. The guy can just write, and what he decides to not write about is as important to me. I mean, one of the early the chefs I worked with early in my career said, it's not just what you cook, it's what you decide to never let out of the kitchen. Sometimes it's about editing. Pete wrote a piece about, and we should talk about this, the famous pop-up restaurant in Mexico that cost $600 plus travel and tip and whatnot, would only be there for a few weeks. Very few people could ever get to it, would ever want to thrash through the jungle and pay the money to go there. And yet top critics from all over the world went there and reviewed it like anybody could go there next Tuesday. And it just made little or no sense. And Pete used it as a way to talk about criticism in general. In our last minute in this segment, Kim, and we have about a minute and 20 seconds. I mean, I always wanted to know where I stood in relation to a critic. And then I could disagree, but I knew where they stood. I knew where Patty Unterman, I knew where Michael Bauer, John Kessler, any New York Times critic. Where do you jump off?
Well, that's a good point. I always want to know where to spend my money. You know, and so some of it is just simply that. I've gone to more hyped restaurants you know, that we're all Instagrammed and people did the plywood report and we've got to get there, and just been so underwhelmed. I like the idea of giving a restaurant, a couple of months to get its act together, and then someone I trust telling me whether I should spend my money there or not. But I don't always agree with a critic, but I just like the idea of the cultural commentary that comes along with good criticism. You know, we may not have wanted to go see every amazing film in the 1970s, but we understood why they were being made and what it meant. And now food is, you know, food is like films were in the 70s or jazz in the 20s, right? It helped us. It's our cultural currency. So I think all of this criticism matters in that way.
I love that, jazz in the 20s. What are you having for lunch? I'm having jazz in the 20s, and it really makes a lot of sense.
I think it's actually a new cocktail, but I'm not sure.
You know, if there's one more cocktail, we should talk about that in our next segment. In about 30 seconds plus commercial time, we're going to talk about cover story. Now, folks, you're mostly reading the New York Times on your phone, let's be honest. But if you knew what a big cover story Kim has just written called Turning Down the Heat, about a chef who got clean and sober and is talking about it, when we come back right here with great sobriety at the table. We are back at the table. I'm talking to Kim Severson of the New York Times, and we've been talking about meat and three. And that usually means three side dishes or three vegetables. Sometimes if you've been working in a high-pressure kitchen, it means three shots of tequila. It's been long known that the restaurant kitchen, and also restaurants in general, are hotbeds of hyperactivity that sometimes lead to the abuse of various substances, not just double espresso. Kim, you've just written a rather extraordinarily large and wonderful piece on the cover of the food section of the New York Times called Turning Down the Heat. I mean, first of all, the idea that a chef is in recovery, is deciding not to use anything, not to drink, and to try to figure out a new way of life is not exactly headline news, but the idea that a young contemporary hot chef would not only go this route, but really talk about it, maybe is a special moment. How did this story in the paper come to be?
Well, it's a kind of a long story, but I wouldn't talk to Sean Brock, who is a chef at Husk Restaurant McCrady's in beloved Charleston. You know, he really is the kind of quintessential Southern food revivalist chef. When you see all those chefs in Brooklyn with tattoos on their arms, a lot of them are emulating Sean Brock style. But this guy is such an intense guy. He wanted to understand the relationship between field peas and rice for a dish called Hoppin' John, and understand the original okra that was brought to this country by enslaved Africans. And so he went, he's done two or three trips to Africa to try to understand where that food came from. He's revived Carolina Gold rice, which is a very particular strain that was grown here in the South, in the rice belt along the Atlantic Ocean. So he's a very serious guy. Also a big partier. He had one of the best bourbon collections in the country. He used to say he wouldn't drink bourbon that was any, unless it was made before like 1994, because he thought that was the great era of American bourbon. So this was a guy who, he would go to bars and drink Budweiser and Jägermeister because he wouldn't drink the bar bourbon because he knew it would be crap. So this guy was serious about his alcohol. And in fact, it got to the point where there was a joke where people would say, let's go get brocked.
Whoa.
And they would be, after a shift, let's go get brocked. But the guy's brilliant, right? So he and I had talked in November. He has an eye disease, myasthenia gravis, which is a rare autoimmune disease. He was going through all these surgeries for his eyes. He wanted me to come write about that and his new restaurant, McGrady's, that was opening. And at that time, I thought, man, this guy is a bit of a mess. And GQ came out with a story right about that same time, kind of showing all of this. And I was like, it's not a good time. I just don't think this is a good story on this guy. And so a couple months ago, he called me up and he said, hey, I just been to rehab and want to talk to you, and sorry I was such a jerk, and this is what my life looks like. And we started talking, and I said, well, if you want to tell your story, I'd be happy to tell it. And so a few weeks ago, we got together, and he told me a story. They just did a good old-fashioned intervention on him in January, and he went off to treatment for 45 days, and has taken up his emotional health with the same intensity that he, you know, that sent him to Africa to understand okra. So he's got about 6 months, but he's really talking about the culture of the kitchen and how, you know, asking for help. You know, you can hide out in restaurant kitchens, as we know. You can be in there with people who are as crazy as you are. You all work really hard together to put out great food. Midnight, 1 o'clock, you're the only ones around. You all go out and get up the next day and do it again. And in that culture, saying I need to do some self-care is, well, you'd be laughed out of the kitchen, right? It's, you know, only the strong survive in the restaurant kitchen. So he's trying to stop that culture from happening, but it's quite a remarkable story, and he was very honest about it with me, and I think that's, and so were the people around him who staged the intervention.
You
I
know,
think it really helped.
Yeah, I have to say that I watched Burnt, that movie with Bradley Cooper recently, and I had to acknowledge that it got most of it right, and it was horrible, but I also can't help thinking that he's kind of an it chef in a kind of an it town. So he's a little bit Nixon to China. He has the opportunity to say, all right, I'm the quintessential something. So I have a right to talk about that something and how it happens some of the time. And in fact, it's useful for people. And yet I keep thinking that it's such an urban thing that because I'm here in the country a lot, because I'm here in farm country, they go crazy. They work their heads off in their restaurant until, oh, I don't know, 9 or 9:15. You know what I mean? It's not midnight. They can't go to an all-night bar downtown where people are taking their clothes off and dancing on the tables. It doesn't exist, and they don't start as early. And so the rhythm is there, the desire for compulsion or for repetition, and for intensity is there, and precision. But for example, I went recently to a three-hour meal, which I rarely do, and I don't seek, believe me, at a new restaurant here called Single Thread. The entire kitchen is open to the entire dining room. There is no way cursing happens. There is no way things get thrown. And at the end of the night, the chef said to me, he wants people to go home after an 11-course meal and feel comfortable physically. And he said, and he wants his chefs to go home at the end of a shift of an evening and feel tired, but satisfied that they've done something, as opposed to burnt out and needing some other kind of alternate experience in order to counter what they've just done unnaturally to themselves. I really think it's an urban or urban translated or transplanted compulsion that is particularly American. And of course, it's always been there. The notion of when early in my career, I would go to Quebec and I would go into a kitchen and all the cooks were men and they were screaming in French, in Quebecois, which is kind of French. And they were smoking cigarettes and they would throw cups of coffee at each other. You know, that's just, I guess, leaving the playground to the kids. But this is a big discussion that we're going to need to start having in a more public way as we completely recalibrate almost everything we know about food, right? Mom was in the kitchen. She may have been sipping off a vodka and soda quietly in her despair, but she was there in the kitchen. And now our whole lives about food have changed so much. When we come back, Kim, I really do want to continue talking about this. I want to talk about not just women in the kitchen and not just alcohol in the kitchen and drugs, let's be honest, but also immigrants in the kitchen. I mean, we are in a moment historically where, I don't know about in your community, but in many of the ones that I'm in, there aren't enough people applying for jobs. They're afraid to apply for jobs because they're not sure, even if their papers are in order, maybe they have a cousin or a relative at home that isn't, and it's kind of a freaky time. Immigration, openness, welcoming and collaboration, camaraderie in the kitchen seems like something worth talking about along with sobriety. All right, Kim, when we come back, let's get back into the serious topic of sober cooking, sober eating, sober living. I don't know, a little balance at the table. All right, we're right back at the table. We're with Kim Severson of the New York Times. We are talking about not just her very, very thorough and thought-provoking story in the New York Times on Wednesday food section about a chef that got sober, but the whole topic. Kim, what's the reaction been like?
It's been more, I think it's been stronger than any piece I've written in a in a while. It really struck a chord. I think part of it is that he was so open, and it was such an intimate piece, but really there's this kind of cloak of self-care that's wrapping around the restaurant industry now that I think is fairly new. There's a website called Chefs with Issues that Kat Kinsman started. She wrote a book called High Anxiety recently, and she's a pretty noted food journalist, and she's asked people to, you know, chefs who have depression, who have substance abuse problems, anger management issues, to, you know, weigh in on this website. She did a mental health survey, which she thought maybe she'd get. It was an anonymous survey, just asking chefs and cooks, people in the hospitality industry, about some of these issues. She thought she'd get a couple hundred responses. She got 2,000.
Whoa.
Crazy. So it's a big issue for folks right now. So I got a lot of feedback about it. A lot of people, I mean, Sean Brock, the subject, wrote to me yesterday, sent me a text and said that five of his friends have written to him about trying to get sober just since the piece came out. So it's something that I think people are talking about. And in part, I want to push back a little on what you said about being an urban issue. I think, you know, if you've ever, I worked at some, you know, chain restaurants
yeah.
when I was working my way through college, but certainly if you've worked at the Longhorn Steakhouse
or the Cheesecake Factory
your long, crazy shift for 7 or 8 hours, at the end of that, I don't care if you're urban or not, there's just that culture to go out and drink and party and blow off steam with your crew. It's just, I think it's endemic to the restaurant business, and you're there trying to make everybody else feel good all the time. You're giving and giving, and there's this real tendency to, you know, I can only feel good if I make this person happy, and I think that can lead to some real addiction issues, that emptiness that you feel constantly trying to make someone else happy as part of your job. The other thing that I think this is an indication of is the beginning of the crumbling of our celebrity chef culture, because I think you take a young man like Sean Brock, who was, you know, working in restaurants since he was 15. His dad had hauled coal for a living. He's this kid from the small town in Virginia, you know, comes and makes a name for himself because he's talented and he loves to cook, and becomes now where he can't walk down the street, you know, without being recognized, and you know, to still has to run a restaurant and perform, but that celebrity, that ego, that draw, you know, that the thing that makes you a celebrity chef, which is ego and talent, right? But also all of us who like look to these guys and men and women and make them rock stars. That's a, you know, that is a dangerous dance. If you have any little holes inside, you know, you're going to collapse pretty quickly. And so I think that as we have elevated chefs into rock stars, I think with that comes some fallout. And this idea of these big names, you know, falling apart publicly or not being able to handle the pressure of that is part of this. I don't know if back in the day, you know, I don't recall that like Wolfgang Puck collapsed under the pressure, but I don't, you know, when we were coming out of the cocaine 80s and into the 90s, I don't know that we had so many chefs kind of collapsing at that level.
It's actually different.
You lived through that, Clark.
Yes, I did. I did. And I will tell you that in the day of Wolf and all those other people, they would just disappear and go to a spa. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, you know, Wolf's, I don't speak for him specifically, but his weight went up and down. Mm-hmm. His skin got tighter after a little vacation or two. His eyes seemed more rested. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Remember, Wolfgang Puck is a creature of Hollywood. So he knows that presentation is one thing and real life is another. But it was a lot harder. I mean, look at Rocco Desperto, front cover of Gourmet magazine with a big fish, big grinning reality TV show. Where is Rocco Desperto? You know, the one thing I remember him saying to me when he was going off to do this show is, I don't want to be a restaurant chef anymore. I just want to do appearances and television and endorse things. You know, I mean, how do you say I want the sprinkles, right? And you're right. Maintaining celebrity is its own full time and a half job. It's not inexpensive. If you are on a reality show, you better have money to begin with, and you better have an extra budget to support that and turn it into all these so-called opportunities. Otherwise, you are going to end up a joke.
Yeah, it is. It is a stunning thing that we put on people, I think, to to do all of this. But then again, they certainly enjoy the limelight when they get it, and understandable. But I also think addiction is addiction, and
yep.
You and I have had this discussion before. I think what's really fascinating to me is, you'll sit and hear people be like, oh, doctors, we all drink a lot. And I'm a journalist. God, boy, we can drink. And I think there are addicts and alcoholics in every profession.
Yep.
And preschool teachers, man, can they drink? I mean, drinkers are everywhere.
It's an issue. But the big difference is that in restaurants, the bottles are actually there on purpose.
Right.
They're part of the activity.
Drink,
yeah.
Right?
Which is, by the way, being phased out in a lot of cases. But and it's not just trying to take care of people all evening. It's watching these people having a celebration, having a good time. It's that vicariousness, the experience that you then want to continue for yourself when it's your turn. All right. We have one more little segment at the end. I want you to tell us a little bit more about what you see coming right out of those great southern cities and into the rest of our culture when we're back here with Kim Severson at the table. We are back at the table with Kim Severson for our last few minutes. Kim, first of all, how do we follow you? How do we reach you? Your stories get shared so much that we can enjoy them that way. But what's the best way to keep after what Kim Severson is writing?
Well, I encourage everybody to follow me on Twitter. I tweet quite a bit, which is just Kim Severson. And Instagram, which is a little bit more personal, and I'm not, that's more sort of stuff from my daily life, at Kim Severson on Instagram. And I have a Facebook page, but I'm just not a Facebooker like other people are. But Twitter and Instagram are big, and you can certainly set up a Google alert and see the stories that I've written. But I really encourage everybody to join us at NYT Cooking. We have a cooking app that we are very proud of, and you can sign up for the newsletter from my boss, Sam Sifton, and get that 5 days a week in your email box. And he occasionally mentions recipes and stories I'm working on, all of us. So please go to NYT Cooking and take a look at that. And then, I'll give you my personal cell phone right now and everybody can call me, and that would be great.
So. Yeah, it happens to be very similar to the one owned by Mitch McConnell. So what annoys you the most? A bad Instagram or a ridiculous tweet about something that you can't quite understand? I mean, when it comes to a restaurant dish, let's just talk about or a plate of food. What is
I do take pictures of what I eat now because it's really great. Because like you, I'm just a bit older now, and I can remember everything I eat, which is great. And it's a wonderful way to keep track of things for reporting. I can take pictures of everything, it's fantastic. The tweeting thing, I have to remember that on Twitter, things can seem very, very big, and really they're not necessarily that big. Somebody will say, Severson's such an idiot and I can't believe this, and they'll troll and do that sort of thing, and I'll just be just destroyed, and then I just need to call up one of the political reporters at the paper, and people are posting, pictures of their heads on animals fornicating, and they're like, I'm sorry they didn't like your cake recipe.
Yeah.
Kid, this is what
let's
real
get a
trolling
grip.
Is.
And let's be honest, some political tweets where all of us are ignoring as a group. Yes. I mean, as time goes along, I have a couple of friends who are trolls. I mean, I have a couple of acquaintances who, they really do like to make...
These aren't exes of yours, are they?
No. Well, they're exes in another way, if you know what I mean.
See.
And there was a time when I tried to kind of counter with something positive, and now I just ignore them. And one of them said to me recently, you haven't been responding. And I said, there's nothing more powerful than indifference, darling. Right?
Isn't
so we don't want to have people be indifferent to us. But in the last 30 seconds, if you wanted to tell everybody listening what to look out for, some wonderful thing to eat immediately that maybe they haven't before that doesn't include sorghum, what might that be?
I think that we all need to go back and rethink hummus. I know it's been out for a while, but I was so off hummus, hated all the hummuses. I don't need another hummus. I was done with the lesbian potluck hummus. None of the hummuses. However, I think the stuff people are doing with dips with, you know, garbanzo beans, with field peas, I think this
We're out of time. I'm gonna make things into hummus, and I'm going to call you up. Lots of love.
Okay,
thank you for being with us.
Come over for hummus.
All right.